Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The magistrate judge's decision and injunction concerning how the Chicago Police Department handles requests by sworn personnel to use comp time contravenes the plain language of Section 20705 and is not authorized by the Fair Labor Standards Act. To read Section 20705 as plaintiffs and the magistrate judge have, the existing words of the statute must be totally rearranged and several words must be added.
I'd like to ask you a sort of bottom line question, if I might, just to start off, and it's this. It's on the question of declaratory relief.
Yes.
And is it the city's position that such relief is unavailable under this statute? I ask you that because you seem to dance around that question a bit in the briefs.
Yes, Your Honor, that kind of relief is not provided for under the statute, much like injunctive relief for private plaintiffs. We don't take the position that such relief is not available. Courts have granted it, and we see no reason why the Declaratory Judgment Act might not apply to give that kind of relief here. Of course, plaintiffs have not provided a basis for that kind of relief, but that would be our position.
Let me ask you another question about the proposed amendments to the regulations, because I know you're familiar with those.
Yes.
Has there been significant opposition to the proposed amendments? Do you know?
I looked last night on the website, http://www.regulations.gov, where the notice and comments have been uploaded. Most of the comments so far have been about other provisions. There have not been that many about this one in particular. There have been a couple going both ways.
Let me ask you this. In light of this suit being filed, because it's pretty clear that there are a lot of different reasons that watch commanders do or don't grant comp time in terms of when they grant it, is the city looking at instituting some standards that watch commanders can use in deciding whether to grant comp time requests?
Well, our position is that watch commanders do have guidelines. They have the general order, which sets out their discretion and the requirements that enough officers be on duty to perform the services that CPD needs to provide. The collective bargaining agreements give them guidance for deciding what priority to grant the elective time. They also have guidance from the Bureau of Patrol, which sets the minimum staffing levels that they need to meet every day. So they have, I think, appropriate guidance given the flexibility of the provision.
So you think that it's enough? What's already there is enough in terms of guidance?
Yes. I mean, these decisions are made, you know, daily on a fluid basis. There are guidelines for how many officers need to be on each watch, on each, you know, beat. And those are not arbitrary. Those are based on historic patterns that the Chicago Police Department has developed, and the Bureau of Patrol, you know, oversees that, and when things need to change, if they do, they adjust those. But
there certainly seem to have been quite a number of arbitrary decisions that have taken place here. And what recourse does the officer have when, for instance, someone has to come home from a Florida vacation for a day or leave their baby's christening or not be able to attend a relative's funeral? What recourse is there?
Well, Your Honor, as we argue, under the provision, a specific day of comp time need not be granted. It just need be granted within a reasonable period. So officers have many other types of elective time at their disposal when they need to take a particular day off. For example, they have vacation days and furlough days.
Yes, but you're not really answering my question, which is, what recourse do they have when, you know, these rather bizarre situations arise?
Well, and hopefully I can finish this and then also add to it. When officers know they need to take a particular day off, there's elective time available to them, which under their own collective bargaining agreements gives priority to those days. So if they know they need
sounds
to be
like
up.
Your answer to Judge Roebner is nothing.
Yes.
There is nothing they can do.
Well, there are instances where they've...
Yeah, maybe nothing is fine.
Right.
Right? There's no provision in the Fair Labor Standards Act for administrative review of these decisions, though it does call into question the city's practice. If I understand the city's practice correctly, if the request for comp time is not granted, it's simply returned. It sounds like the city's practice is inconsistent with the statute, as you're arguing for the statute's meaning here, which is that the worker tenders a request and now the employer has a reasonable time to comply. But instead of taking a reasonable time to comply, the city just returns the request.
Well, there's no requirement that a request be allowed for a specific day.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But as you've argued in your brief, the requirement is that once somebody requests comp time, the employer has a reasonable time to provide it. But that's not what the employer does. If the city were taking its own legal position seriously, it would log the request for comp time and recognize that the clock is now ticking. And it would then provide a time within a reasonable time. But as I say, you apparently agree that's not what happens.
That's not what happens, but there's no evidence that comp time was not allowed to be used within a reasonable time. Under the statute, there's no requirement that the employer offer an alternative day. Under the system as CPD has set it up.
As you have argued, a particular day is completely outside the statutory scope. The employee has no right to a particular day. He only has a right to comp time within a reasonable time of a request. And that sounds like you get a request, the clock is now ticking, and the employer had better provide it within a reasonable time. That's not what Chicago does.
No, but we also do allow the comp time to be used within a reasonable period. There's no evidence
how
here.
How can we tell?
Because, for example, in Beck, there was evidence at page 916.
I didn't ask about some other case. I asked, how can we tell here?
Well, in that case, there was evidence
that... ask about some other case. How can we tell on this record?
There's no evidence here that comp time was not allowed within a reasonable period. And to contrast...
How can we tell on this record is the question.
Because there is no evidence of a routine or systematic...
You're as uncooperative with me as you were with Judge Roebner. Let's go back to the very beginning, which is the appropriate relief in this case. When the court asked you the question, why should there be an injunction as opposed to damages, it was thinking not only about 29 U.S.C. 217, but the venerable doctrine that there is no, that an injunction is inappropriate unless there's irreparable injury. I don't understand how there's irreparable injury in this case, because after all, what we're talking about is payment for overtime. There are two ways to pay for overtime under the Act. One is in cash and the other is with comp time. And if you don't pay properly with comp time, then you have to pay in cash. I don't see where the irreparable injury is.
Well, we would submit that if the statute is read as plaintiffs propose it to be, then there would be an injury, and that's
obviously
there would
be an injury. I don't understand why it's irreparable. You pay time and a half for overtime. That's what the FLSA is all about.
That's correct, and there's been no claim here that plaintiffs haven't been compensated for that time.
Exactly. So you pay them cash. Where's the irreparable injury? This is why I don't begin to understand how this could be a suit ending in an injunction as opposed to an award of damages.
Well, we certainly agree that an injunction would not be appropriate here, and given that plaintiffs have abandoned...
No, the reason you're arguing an injunction is inappropriate is because you think you win on the merits. I'm trying to gauge between remedies, assuming you lose on the merits.
And plaintiffs have, you know, abandoned their damages claim, so there would be no effective...
No, I don't think one can abandon a damages claim. Rule 54C says that the prevailing party gets the relief to which it is entitled no matter what it asked for. That's what the rule says.
And
so if the relief to which the plaintiff is entitled is money rather than an injunction, that's what the plaintiff gets.
And there would be no likely damages here, which is why the plaintiffs have probably not pursued
it. Why would there be no likely damages if, for instance, a police officer goes to Florida with his family and is told to return home for one day, having to pay for an air ticket, and then, you know, returning? Surely that would be a damage, would it not?
If proven that that specific day of comp time had to be granted, that there was no undue disruption for not granting that request, and if he had to return, had no other elective time available to him, which he does, to ensure that he has that specific day off, then perhaps that individual would have a damages claim. But plaintiffs have never pursued their case that way. They've been very clear that they're trying to change how the Chicago Police Department's overall policy and practices work. So any individual damages claim they may have, they have decided not to present proof on, and they have abandoned that claim.
Well, surely if the case were sent back with instructions, they'd be proving damages up the wazoo, would they not?
They would certainly have the opportunity to then, yes, but they have been very clear that that's not what they're seeking with this case.
I hope up the wazoo is not a bad way.
Anything Ronald Reagan used in public, a judge can use in public.
And we would submit that the rigid requirements that plaintiffs are trying to impose on this provision that is intentionally broad, such as that it creates a notice requirement, that it requires the specific day requested to be granted, that it requires the employer to offer an alternative day as opposed to having the employee request another day, that it requires in every instance that a replacement be sought so that that specific day can be taken, those things are simply not found in the provision's plain language. Rather, all that it requires is that the use of comp time.
How often do officers end up with more than 480 hours of comp time?
There's no evidence of that in the record, of exactly how many days each of these 2,000 plaintiffs had of comp time accrued. But it's clear that they have been allowed to use comp time. In fact, the record is clear that almost all requests for specific days, even though that is not required, were allowed. It's also clear from the record that sometimes alternative days were offered and that replacements were sometimes sought when it was necessary to accommodate the use of comp time.
Isn't there some validity to the view that the unduly disrupt language doesn't make much sense unless the employer has some duty to honor the particular dates that the employee is requested to use his comp time? I mean, when would there ever be undue disruption if the employer is free to choose different dates?
Well, that's where the definition of reasonable period comes in, because if the request cannot be allowed, then the undue disruption exception would apply.
Unfortunately, that seems to make the statute very weird. If you don't ask for a particular date, but just open a window, on the city's reading, if I understand it, if you can't give the worker time off within a reasonable time, then you can take an unreasonable time. And that doesn't make any sense. The plaintiff's view, on the other hand, is that you ask for a particular time, and if that would cause undue disruption, then the employer can take a reasonable time to provide comp time. But your view of undue disruption is something that prevents the use of time during the reasonable time and thus leads the employer to be able to use an unreasonable time. Can't be right, can it?
I would argue that in Mortenson, for example, the employees and employers agreed to a reasonable period of 1 year. So in that instance, the employee could approach the employer to say, I want to use comp time, and then figure out within that 1 year when the comp time could be used. And if within that 1 year...
The city and the police union agreed on 1 year as a reasonable time?
No, they have not. But
well,
that's
then fine. So forget about that.
Well, that's just an example of the flexibility that's built into this provision so that individual employers and employees can figure out how it best works within their operations. So here, the employers haven't agreed to what a reasonable period means. We're guided by the factors in the regulation about, you know, what to use to determine whether there's a reasonable period. And if under the CPD system, if a request for that specific day cannot be allowed, then it is denied as unduly disruptive. The point is that there's many ways to comply with this provision. It's intentionally flexible.
I don't think, however, that you're addressing my question, which had to do with whether your legal interpretation of the relation between the phrases undue disruption and reasonable time doesn't drive one to the conclusion that the city is arguing for the ability to use an unreasonable time. It's a question about your interpretation of the statute, and if you would address that, I would appreciate it.
I don't think that it's saying that we would allow the use within an unreasonable time. If it won't be allowed, if it can't be allowed within a reasonable period, then it's appropriately denied as being unduly disruptive.
Yes. Well, I give up.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Well, you talked about all these different ways that someone's request could be met when I was asking you about perhaps having some standards that watch commanders could use. I mean, all these different alternatives, they are not in one particular section. I mean, there's been nothing given to watch commanders that lays out all these choices.
Well, they do have...
I mean, you're talking about pulling from various pieces rather than having something that a watch commander could sit down and make sure that, you know, that we could tell whether or not the watch commander was actually applying all these different things. I mean, there's no way we can... There's no built-in... You know, it's just very amorphous in terms of when a request is denied or granted.
They certainly have guidelines, and they are trained on those guidelines, and most requests are allowed again, so you know there should not be a complaint heard about that. But when requests are denied as unduly disrupted, the watch commanders are guided by those things, and they've been working, you know, in that district on that watch for a good amount of time, so they know, you know, when things need to be fully staffed and when comp time is could be appropriately allowed. And because the employer is only required to allow it within a reasonable period, the fact that the linchpin of plaintiff's argument that they should be able to get a specific day when specific days are largely granted under the system that the Chicago Police Department has created.
What harm would there be in putting together one plan so that everyone, you know, knew the parameters so that it wouldn't seem vindictive in certain instances, so that, you know, people would, the officers would feel that they're being treated fairly in all respects. What is wrong with a real plan? Not something here, something there, something up there, something from here.
Well, certainly that makes perfect sense to have
and
a uniform.
And then you wouldn't have had to have mm-hmm. been here spending, I take it, hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayers' money. And making morale in the department go down.
It certainly makes sense, Your Honor. And our main submission is that is the flexibility that the Fair Labor Standards Act has granted employers so that these things, you know, can be figured out within the operations that the employer needs to implement. And certainly, you know, this case has prompted and will prompt more discussions on that, but it should be a focus on what the Act actually requires. And we submit it does not require that a specific day be granted or that replacements be sought in every instance. I would like to save the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you. Thank you.
Certainly, Counsel. Mr. Geiger.
May it please the Court, Counsel. Your Honor asked a question about officers having more than 480 hours, and I would like to.
Judge Roper didn't ask
Judge
that
question. Judge Roper did. I apologize.
In any event, that's not where we need to start. We need to start with what the city characterizes as a question of subject matter jurisdiction.
Mm-hmm. Correct. If we start with the subject matter jurisdiction of this court, I will acknowledge for Your Honor and this court that we have much difficulty arguing the injunctive relief in terms of the injury itself.
Well, we start with Section 217, I suppose,
right.
And 211 make it, I would have thought, clear that only the Secretary of Labor can get equitable relief under the Act. But I take it you disagree with the city's proposition that this is jurisdictional.
I do disagree with that proposition because, given, I know it's not binding on this court, but we've seen an injunction entered before in the federal court system.
I don't see what that has to do with jurisdiction. Sometimes judges don't adequately attend to jurisdiction.
We
need to argue this out on the basis of what's in the statute, not on the basis of errors that may have been made in the past.
Well, my difficulty is arguing it out on the statute, from our perspective, is very difficult because I don't believe that I can counter the plain language of the statute in terms of jurisdiction.
The question is not whether the statute authorizes injunctions in private suit. Plainly, it does not. And it isn't even whether there's irreparable injury, because I can't see how you could possibly show irreparable injury. The question is whether that is a defect of subject matter jurisdiction. Normally, we think of jurisdiction to entertain a claim, not jurisdiction to provide a particular remedy.
Correct. And I think, you know, when it gets down to when I think of subject matter jurisdiction, I think of power. And does the court have the power to do what it did in that case? And I haven't seen, I understand that.
Actually, not the question. The question is whether the court has what the Supreme Court refers to as adjudicatory competence. Not the power to do what it did, but the power to decide.
Well, it certainly has the power to decide, and I think the Supreme Court, we looked long and hard when Your Honor posed the issue to us to address about the injunctive relief. And if one goes back and looks at our prayer for relief in our combined motion for summary judgment, number one, we asked for a declaration. In our initial complaint, we asked for a declaration of rights. I think we were somewhat clear on that, and we wound up going beyond that. And perhaps that was because of the city's reluctance to even discuss working it out with the relevant unions.
Let me focus again on jurisdiction.
Okay.
My question for you is, why isn't subject matter jurisdiction provided by 28 U.S.C. 1331? That is, you've made a claim that arises under federal law. You may not be entitled to the remedy you sought, but one would think 1331 is an adequate grant of subject matter jurisdiction. Now, maybe I'm missing something, but I would have thought that that's the beginning and the end of the jurisdictional inquiry, and after that we just have a dispute about appropriate remedies.
Right. And I believe that is exactly the case, that we do have a dispute about appropriate remedies.
Now, assume that an injunction is unavailable.
Yes.
Would the record support an award of damages?
The record would support an award of damages, Your Honor.
And why?
Well, because there were a number of individuals who can show an actual financial damage to having been denied the use of their comp time. There's also an injury, while it might not be financial in nature, to officers who are denied.
When you say denied comp time, the question that this raises in my mind is, do you mean just their first request was denied, or they then submitted another within a reasonable time and had it rejected too in sequence, so that if you measure from the initial request to when they actually got time off, more than a reasonable time elapsed, that would be, by the city's concession, a violation of the Act. Is there evidence in the record from which a judge could conclude that that kind of thing has occurred?
Well, that, with particularity, the way Your Honor phrased it, I don't believe so, because the system that the city has in place does not function that way.
I perfectly understand the city system doesn't function that way, but your clients have their own records.
Correct.
That is, your clients can tell the court, I filed a request in January, it was rejected. I filed it again in February, it was rejected. I filed it again in March, it was rejected. And by April, a reasonable time had run out.
Well, we don't, as a matter of practical speaking for our clients, if they're filing a request during these different months, I assume they're asking for a particular day off, perhaps July 1 for a wedding. And once that first denial comes into play, February, whatever it might have been, the first month, there is no second request for it. It does not happen because they're not granted. There's no redress. There's no redress.
Completely lost. Surely you don't mean to say that if one of the plaintiffs files a request for comp time and it's denied, he never again in his life seeks comp time.
No, he seeks comp time, but for different dates. Yes, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. And then you're saying they don't have any records either on, you know, whether they hit the 480 or not, that number, and if they didn't get their comp time, you know, being paid.
Judge, I'm glad you
don't have those records either.
I'm glad you asked that, because the 480 is the FLSA limit, as you are, I'm certain, are aware. And what the city does is the city maintains two compensatory time banks for each officer, FLSA time, non-FLSA time. And if you really look at the FLSA time, the city has a policy, a written policy, against awarding overtime to police officers. Very little is actually awarded. When you look at a 13,000-strong police department, there is not a tremendous amount of overtime given. But what happens is, when you get that true in excess of 171 hours worked FLSA overtime, it is treated as if it were the contractual overtime that the city is very generous with, let's say. That was the city's phrase. And, in fact, there are officers with 15,000. I believe named plaintiff Lenane for the supervisors has 6,000 hours of time. Now, we don't mean to suggest as plaintiffs that he can take the last 3 years of his career off. We're not saying we can force the city into a position where we can have a specific day, week, month, or year off. But what we're saying is there has to be some sort of something we can rely on to know.
Does this mean that the record doesn't show whether officers approach or go over the 480-hour limit?
As a general rule, all the records are in the record. They, as a general rule, do not go over the 480 for FLSA hours. For non-FLSA, they go into the thousands, and they are treated identically, except the city removes the FLSA hours from the bank when you request to use them. Hence, our plaintiffs were trimmed down from a 2,000 to less than 200 because they don't have the hours. The supervisor plaintiffs are trimmed
down.
You
mean
they don't have the FLSA hours?
They don't have FLSA hours, Your Honor.
You don't mean they don't have the hours,
right?
Because they're in the other bank.
Correct. They're in the other bank, and they are all treated as one. And then the city is heard to argue in its briefs that there will be some sort of financial bankrupting of the system if we win this case, that there will be this unbreakable and ever-increasing cycle of comp time. And that is as false as it gets. When I say we, I mean my co-counsel in this case, we tried to imagine a scenario where that could happen. And I submit, mathematically, any formula you put to it, You cannot create that ever-increasing and unbreaking chain of increased comp time and overtime being paid if people want to use their FLSA hours. It cannot be done. And there's a dire warning in the opening and the reply briefs about it being done, but as a factual matter, there's nothing but this dire warning. As a factual matter, it cannot happen. Compliance in this case will cost the city, in terms of compliance with the FLSA, very, very little.
So was some kind of chart submitted in terms of, I'm still trying to figure out what the damages would be. Was like a chart submitted that showed, you know, the number of hours that were under 480, for example, and how many officers were there. Then another chart that shows, you know, the other bank, and then something else that shows how many went from FLSA to the other bank, because that's what you're saying happens. The city fulfills the requirement by taking hours out of the other bank, right?
Well, no. What they do, Your Honor, is when an officer, let's say I have 8 FLSA hours and 100 non-FLSA hours in my bank, and I want to take Friday off, and I submit my request to take the time off. Mm-hmm. I don't submit a request to take the non-FLSA hours off. The department automatically deducts the FLSA hours. In other words, no matter when you earn FLSA hours, they are first out. That would be the accounting principle. Any time in, first out, as far as the city sees it.
Now, and how did that come to be?
I do not know mm-hmm. how that accounting practice came to be. Comp time is...
Well, surely someone asked somewhere along the way,
well,
how did this come to be historically, didn't they?
The questions were posed, but it is our difficulty getting answers in this case has been unbelievable. We have, to a man, every supervisor from sergeant on up,
to a man and woman,
I'm sorry, Your Honor. To a man and a woman, every single supervisor admitted they were never given any instruction. One of them wavered on it and then later admitted, true, no FLSA instruction. So what the department has created, and they say there's several units, no, there's dozens upon dozens, is all these individual fiefdoms where middle mm-hmm. management mm-hmm. controls your ability to take time off. And that is wrong.
Well, the fiefdom is each watch commander.
Exactly. Each unit has a watch commander. And these are the individual fiefdoms that exist throughout this department, and they are the gatekeepers of your time. And that is the problem. We look at these cases, Mortensen and Houston, which, you know, admittedly, those are the two big cases going against Judge Shankier's interpretation and, indeed, the interpretation we urge of the statute. However, Houston, Mortensen, they had agreements. They had, in Houston, it was 10%. In Mortensen, I believe he worked at a jail, it was 3 people can be off during the week, 4 people can be off during the weekend. They knew what the program was. And there's this suggestion throughout both of the circuit court opinions that the employees were trying to kind of pull a fast one and force them to take a day off. We can't even begin to get to that point because in our case, we don't have any agreement. We don't have any knowledge. They talk about minimum staffing, but no officer knows what it is and what it means. It means different things to different people. And some supervisors think it means everybody must come to work, and some supervisors think very few people must come to work. And that has to stop. And if there's not any more questions, I certainly thank you for the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Geiger. Anything further?
Our position is that you always must grant it the use of comp time within a reasonable time. And that was done here because most comp time requests were used. And only if the request is unduly disruptive to the operations has it been denied. It's not that you can take an unreasonable amount of time to decide the request or to then allow the use of comp time. Under the record here, comp time was allowed within a reasonable period. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.